I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. What if you couldn't trust anyone? What if you couldn't trust your government, your employer, your family? What if they lied to you, abducted you, tortured, murdered, and even stole your children? Tony Robbins argues that repeated and prolonged forms of betrayal result in sociocultural trauma. Tony is a professor emeritus of anthropology at Utrecht University. He spent his career studying Argentina, and he believes that sociocultural trauma caused by repeated forms of betrayal are what afflicts the people of Argentina. Betrayal, Tony argues, never ended in Argentina, even after the end of military dictatorship. Instead, it took on new forms, took the form of governments taking ever-shifting positions towards the past, sometimes prosecuting and memorializing, sometimes forgiving and forgetting, took the form of military leaders refusing to take responsibility for the past and refusing to reveal where the disappeared are buried. Betrayal, Tony argues, makes it impossible to mourn, to make sense of the past, and to move on. A conversation with Tony Robbins about his book, Argentina Betrayed, Memory, Mourning, and Accountability, in this episode of Realms of Memory. Tony, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, and you begin your book and you talk about how you're recalling a memory in your own life of being at the Plaza de Mayo. I had to listen to you pronounce that several times. The Plaza de Mayo on December 10th, 1983, and the then president Raul Alfonsin is arriving, and there are all these expectations of what's going to happen, and then you say when you fast forward several decades into the future. At least when you were writing the book, and you know the book came out in 2016, it seemed like a lot of those expectations had been dashed. I don't know whether that's since changed. If you get updated to 2025,
let me start with that day on the 10th of December 1983 because it's still very vivid in my memory. And in Argentina, it's the procedure that when you are inaugurated in Congress. Then after, you go in an open car, in a sedan, you go to the presidential palace because then you have been inaugurated as a president. And there's an avenue, Avenida de Mayo, May Avenue, that links Congress to the presidential palace. So he starts in Congress and then takes the routes about, well, let's say 1.5 mile to the presidential palace. And the street is lined with people. It's also summer because Southern Hemisphere. So I vividly remember how I was standing there on the sidewalk with, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And I see Alfonsin passing in his white shirt, short-sleeved, really beaming, and now I'm going to be president. I'm going to be the first democratic president after the military dictatorship, and I'm going to change things in this country. And the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to resolve these thousands of disappearances. People want to know what has happened to their son, daughter, mother, father, sister, husband, wife. So that was his first obligation to the Argentine people. The thing is, the tragedy is, there was installed a truth commission, not a truth and reconciliation commission as you had in Chile. It was a truth commission that tried to find out what has happened to these people. So this commission then visited dozens, hundreds of what was called secret detention centers to find any traces of these people who were disappeared, and they didn't find any. So that was the first, almost promise that he made to the Argentine people that he could not resolve, that he could not live up to. And if you then fast forward to the present day, what you see is a denial of many of these things, is that the military are once again, especially under the impetus of the vice president, Villarreal, who is saying, well, you know, it wasn't that bad and it was necessary to save the country, et cetera, et cetera. So I think he would, you know, turn in his grave to see what has come of this country, because he was one of the, he was the first president to also start this whole memorialization of what happened. He was the first president who put the military juntas on trial. Five members of these juntas were convicted. And later, a couple of years later, they were free again because of amnesties and pardons. So the contrast between the Day of Hope on the 10th of December 1983 and today, the 22nd of February 2025, has completely dissipated. And the military, until now, and many of them have died, of course, the commanders, have not opened their secret vaults and letting the people know what has happened to these people. Because I am convinced that they have records of where these people went, when they were killed, and where they were, and where their remains were deposited. If not, they had been incinerated or thrown in the Atlantic Ocean.
Hmm. So there has been justice. There are people that were put on trial. There are hundreds of people, former officers that are in jail, maybe still in jail. But that past has not been fully revealed, right? And cooperation with the authorities has never really been, has never fully happened.
No, what has happened is that justice in Argentina has been a roller coaster. There have been periods of prosecution, time when the military were convicted, then usually followed by a period of amnesty or a presidential pardon. Then they got out. And then years later, these same people who got their amnesties and presidential pardons, as a matter of fact, were then in jail again on other charges. You see, in 1985, these commanders of the military juntas were convicted for the disappearances, for the torture, for, you could say, the state terror. But you cannot convict a person twice for the same offense. That's the rule of law in all, let's say, democratic countries. So in 1990-91, they were arrested again, these junta members, on the charge of kidnapping. Because what had happened, that during the military dictatorship, they had stolen many babies and infants from the political activists and also guerrillas that they had killed. And these children and babies were then adopted by military families, families of the police. So now they could try them for kidnapping. And then, you see, at a certain moment in Argentine law, if I am correct, I think at the age of 80, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's 80, 70, could be 75, could be 80. You have the same rule, by the way, in Spain. Then you're considered too old to be in prison. So then you can go into house arrest. So many of these aging dictators and many of these aging military then were at home and died there. A total of about 1,000 officers were convicted. A number of them died, but there's still officers in prison. It's not the type of prison you can imagine. It's not Sing Sing or Alcatraz. These are often prisons on military bases. They have a tennis court. They have a football field. They get good food. They have their barbecue. But of course, they're in prison. And now there's a movement, again, by certain groups within the retired military to get them out again, to say, well, they have done their time and it's time to reconcile Argentine society. So what you see a roller coaster of periods in which there is accountability and persecution, and other periods where there's amnesty and pardons, and there's a call for what they call a reconciliation of Argentine society. So that's why the roller coaster.
Mm. And I think the main theme, or the guiding theme of your book, is that you can't understand this, how people experience the period of dictatorship from 1970 1986 until 1983. And you can't understand how that experience lives on after the dictatorship unless you look at these dynamics of trust and betrayal. And what you're talking about is a roller coaster of memory. That also that's the theme of one of your chapters, of how that plays on trust and betrayal. And you start your book and you explain how this is like just a fundamental glue for society. So how does that, what is the significance of trust? What happens when trust is betrayed? In what ways is it betrayed during that period of military rule? How does it keep on getting betrayed afterwards? And what's the impact on society of that?
Yeah, I think it's because there's so many periods that are alternating. I think a good illustration would be the day of today. There are now many military, also some judges, some prosecutors from the dictatorship, some businessmen who are in jail. They have been convicted. It has gone to the high court. There, the conviction was confirmed, so they should be in jail. And now there are voices within the government that, well, you know, they also saved the country from communism, so we should let them free. Now, this is an example of betrayal. It's not only a betrayal of the people who and the victims and the relatives of the victims, but it's also a betrayal of the rule of law. Once you betray the rule of law, what you have left, then anything goes. And next, and that is, of course, a major concern, let's assume that this 83-year-old general gets free and he's at home with his grandchildren. That's one thing. But the whole memory about what has happened in the past and what has happened during the dictatorship also is deeply affected. And you see that today in a very, very literal way. There have been budget cuts in the Secretariat of Human Rights. So places, secret detention centers that have turned into places of memory, into sites of memory, are now falling apart, literally falling apart, roofs coming down, windows collapsing, because there is nobody to maintain it. There's no money. And the people who are supposed to maintain it have been fired. As a matter of fact, there is one, let's say, the most famous and iconic, if you can use that term, secret detention center is the Navy School of Mechanics. And this Navy School of Mechanics was considered by UNESCO as a World Heritage place. That was in the beginning of last year, I guess. Could be the beginning of 2023, or at least the beginning of 2024. Now, what has happened is that museum now, the people who are running the museum have been fired. And actually, policemen have been posted at the door, so these employees cannot enter. The museum cannot enter those places. So
because this is the politics of memory of the current administration, you mean? They're starving these sites of memory of funds. They're firing their staff.
That is happening today. Also, there are still trials going on. But if you start a trial against a military commander, then you need an investigation. You need a thorough investigation. Well, the team that does these investigations has been fired. So the prosecutor, and then as a result, the judge, can do very little. Also, there has been talk about destroying the archives of the Navy. Well, that's one of the sources where this investigative team gets their data to then hand them to the prosecutor so you can have a trial. So on all sides, there are ways in which to undermine the rule of law and to undermine the human rights advances that have been going on in the country. Worse even, there are still grandmothers who are looking for their grandchildren who have been robbed, have been stolen, and they cannot because there's no money. There's no money for DNA testing. There's talk about that there's a file with DNA of hundreds of thousands of people, of also closing that. So you can see that little by little steps are taken to dismantle this whole memory of the dictatorship being a period of state terrorism that is now being dismantled by the current administration of Javier Milei.
But this is, again, going back to another period in the past where the emphasis was more on forgetting, right? But I want to dig into this idea of trust.
Yeah.
And partly for selfish reasons, because I'm living under a president where everything is about transactions, right? It's about deals, and relationships don't really seem to matter a whole lot. And we just got back from this Munich conference that shocked Europeans that, this is maybe they're not going to be able to trust the U.S. anymore as a partner to play that role. And it's all about transactions. I was reading this article about the U.S. basically trying to extract concessions from Ukraine. Well, we'll support your security as long as we have access to those mineral resources. And it's a transactional relationship. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is, trust matters. And it's at the core of these relationships. And if you go back to relationships that hold together society, and trust within families, trust between the state and the people, trust between security forces and the people. And what's the impact if you just completely ignore that, or that gets abused, and you begin with the period of military rule, and you talk about, what does that mean? Betrayal of trust. So I was hoping you could comment a little bit about that. What are the ways in which trust gets betrayed in terms of all these different relationships repeatedly?
Let me give you two examples. One is how to, both about how to betray trust, but also how to use trust as a political weapon. The first example I give is, you had an admiral who was Admiral Massera, Emilio Massera, who was a member of the first military junta in 1976. And I have spoken to people who were able to talk to him in person, talking about the disappearance of their son. And he would tell them, Mrs. So-and-so, your son most likely was killed by the guerrillas. If not, I will do everything in my power to find your son, knowing that this son was in the hands of his henchmen at the Navy School of Mechanics. There's another example of how trust can be used to manipulate things. When the Mothers of the Place de Mayo also approached Massera, he would talk to a couple of them and say at a certain moment, I might help you with this. I might help you with this if you will then denounce the other people within your organization. So I can help you to find your son, but then that has a price to it. Now, what happens here is that he is using trust to divide this group. Because if a couple of people would be able to recover their sons or the remains, then they would then lose then they would no longer be politically active to fight for the disappeared. It would create divisiveness within a particular organization. And if you want to take it to the present with the President of the United States, you see that happening also. Division. So promising some things to some people, not promising something to somebody else, and play with this continuously. And that's what the military did. So when they were out of power in 1983, they also tried to make deals. and said, well, you know, if you won't prosecute us, then we might release some of the information, et cetera, which they never did, not until the day of today. So trust is continuously manipulated. And the thing is that many people, because the way, you know, they've been raised in our types of societies, we tend to trust politicians. So when a politician says something, we have a tendency, at least in my country, but I think also in the United States, that you tend to believe them. You know, why would they betray us? Now, in Argentina, people have been betrayed way back. You know, the first military coups were in the 1930s. And I spoke to this with Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. And they said, why would you go to a military commander knowing that he will lie to you? And they said, but what alternative do I have? I have no alternative. Maybe he will tell the truth. Maybe he can help me. Maybe through a priest, through a bishop I know, I can make contacts and I can save my son or daughter. Of course, it didn't help. Not even sons and daughters of military commanders who were also kidnapped and disappeared, and their fathers, who were military men themselves, went to their commanders and said, I'm almost certain that you have my son. And the commander would say, I do have your son, but you did not raise him properly. If you have raised him properly, he would not be against us. So this betrayal of trust even occurred within military ranks against
and within families. I mean, you give one example that shocked me about this particular these two brothers what happens? Could you tell that story of the what happens between these two brothers and the extent of betrayal in that case?
Yeah, these are two brothers in which one is a officer and the other one is a political activist, maybe linked to the guerrilla. And so what happens is that this brother, who's the activist, he and his wife are being abducted. They're being tortured. They're being faced with one another, the wife and the husband, and they say they don't know each other. They have a child, and the child is then legally adopted by the uncle, who is partly responsible for the disappearance of his brother. And the horrible thing is also that the father of these two brothers says, yeah, I have one son who died, and the other son I don't have anymore because, you know, he's a traitor. What is also remarkable, that this little girl that was adopted became at a certain moment a member of parliament. You know, the uncle said, well, I tried to do the best for you. I saved you your life, which is a common thing to instill guilt. See, that's what they would say because there were, of course, guerrilla insurgents in Argentina. And what was common, especially among a group called the Montoneros, they would have a cyanide capsule. And when they had the idea that the military were going to detain them, they would bite on their cyanide capsule and die, because they said it's better to die than to be tortured and betray your comrades. But what the military then did, they immediately tried to get that capsule or inject the person with an antidote. And then say, you see, your organization ordered you to commit suicide and we saved you. You have your life thanks to us. So come and work with us, collaborate with us, tell us what you know, etc., etc. So this also was part of this betrayal of trust, of manipulating people, of instilling guilt, instilling shame, all very devious ways in trying to what they considered as an existential fight, a just war against the communists who were trying to take over Argentina.
So you offer so many examples of trust betrayal, even within families. If you have somebody disappeared within your own families, your sisters, brothers might completely distance themselves. You mentioned from the family that experiences that kind of trauma because they're afraid it might happen to them. So there's so many cases that you offer, but you link this to this idea of sociocultural trauma, right? That if you have the experience of repeated betrayal of trust, you count on your government to protect you. Instead, it kidnaps, tortures you. You count on government to be honest, to serve your needs, and instead it lies to you. And if this happens repeatedly, you mention, because it's not a given that you're going to be traumatized by this. There are lots of cases where you mention that people, just like societies, are pretty resilient. They find coping mechanisms. They can bury themselves in work. And I'm thinking of Germany after World War II or Japan after World War II. Maybe you bury yourself in work and maybe you forget that. You're able to move on. You find a new identity. But if you're repeatedly betrayed, you suffer this, you're just prolonged period of distrust, you can end up traumatized. And that seems to be what happens to Argentina.
Yeah.
And it seems to play out in terms of a splintering effect. Is this something you can elaborate on?
Yeah, let me first explain what a sociocultural trauma is, because there's a common tendency to say, well, those people have been traumatized or that society has been traumatized, what has happened? Well, the thing is that a sociocultural trauma is a consequence of the difficulty to mourn your losses. You cannot cope with your losses. You have no way to accept those losses. And betrayal is one of the reasons why you cannot accept them. So if you take Germany as a case, well, in Nazi Germany, the millions of people that after the Second World War, Germany did everything to try to cope with their losses and to memorialize them and to have people accept those losses and to have the curricula in schools where school children are visiting concentration camps. I don't want to get too much into Japan, but Japan is a case where the entire society sees itself as a victim of the atomic bomb. And there you do not have this whole memorialization and this acceptance of guilt and the losses. Now, this social culture trauma has two sides to it. As the adjective sociocultural says, it has a social dimension. And in the social dimension, that means that a society cannot cope with its losses. While in its cultural dimension, it means that these losses are so indelible that they cannot find meaning. People cannot find meaning to them. Why did this happen to this society? What did we do wrong? And that raises the question of collective guilt. Are we collectively guilty? Is there something in this society that makes it that these things happen to us? So rather than cases of individual guilt and says, well, it is, let's say, Videla, or in Germany, it's Adolf Hitler. In Germany, at a certain moment, the idea arose, well, it's not simply Adolf Hitler. It's the whole society collectively bears a burden of the Second World War, and in a way is responsible. And in Argentina, society is struggling with that idea. It's still very much an emphasis on there were victims of dictatorship and the military were responsible for all these horrible things that have happened to societies, and part of the Roman Catholic Church and some businessmen who profited from this dictatorship. So that leads to the conclusion that I do not find, and that's my opinion, of course, that I do not find Germany a traumatized society, although there should be one footnote that with the reunification of Germany, East and West Germany, in West Germany, there was this emphasis on memorialization and on accepting this collective guilt, while in East Germany it wasn't, because they were the good communists who had fought the fascists. And now, tomorrow, there are elections in Germany, we see the consequences of that, because the extreme right is the one that gets most many votes in former East Germany. Now, in Argentina, you see something similar happening. You see something that I would almost say a maverick president as Javier Milei won the elections with incredible promises. I will end inflation. This will be a rich country again. You know, the eternal thing that you hear in Argentina. We were at the beginning of the 20th century, one of the richest countries in the world. And because of the military coups and because of Peronism, Juan Domingo Perón, the movement of Juan Domingo Perón, we are now in the predicament in which we are. And I'm going to end inflation. But as part of this, you see, the current government is using the same, you know, neoliberal policies which the military dictatorship used. They also said we had runaway inflation, we're going to curb the inflation, and we're going to make this into a rich country. So you see all these links between the past and the present. So that led to a move towards the political right in Argentina, and the country is suffering from it. Inflation has gone down, but poverty has gone up tremendously. And the question is, where will it end? There's a good chance that it will lead to another period of another government, a more leftist government, who will then start printing money again to support their supporters. And in the meantime, the whole memorialization of the past dictatorship has been dismantled. So even though maybe in a couple of years voters might vote again for the party that was in power before Milei, something has happened. Something has happened to this in this memory politics, to this memorialization of Argentina.
Okay. So I want to go back to this point about mourning, which I thought was fascinating. And I interviewed David Reif about his book In Praise of Forgetting. And he argues, well, mourning is a natural process and you move on and you don't mourn forever. And he was critical of memory. Memory prolongs the process endlessly, especially when you formalize a memory. And he said, you need to remember things maybe as long as the people who directly experience it, maybe their extended family members are alive. After that, move on, no matter what it is. In this case, it seems that you can't figure out a way to mourn collectively, maybe, that you have groups that splinter into their own ways of remembering the past, and they're almost stuck in a rumination mode, and they can't move beyond that. There's no larger conversation between them, right? And so you're stuck in the past, reliving the past endlessly, not being able to achieve any kind of closure. That seems to be that's the problem. And you stress that this plays out within particular contexts, right? That there are these larger memory contexts that Argentina goes through, and for most of them, you've got these groups that are competing over the past, and some are able to assert their memory over others, and there are certain reasons for that, and. Where at least when you finish your book, which was, again, it was 2016, and maybe we've gone back in time. But when you finish, there was a kind of a larger collective understanding of the past that seemed to be in the making with the idea of genocide. But what are these different periods of memory that Argentina goes through? Who are the groups? Because not every group seems to be. There's some groups that seem to get sidelined. There's some groups that are more important. So what are the groups that are competing over the past? How do some how do some gain greater importance than others?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I would like to go back to the idea of mourning and forgetting. Because respectfully, I completely disagree with that view. And the idea that mourning should lead to closure goes back to Freud. And Freud said, mourning is basically a form of reality testing. There's a denial of death of a person, and eventually you come to accept it. And that's the process of mourning. It's working through, it's working through that relationship. And ultimately, the affective relationship with the deceased is cut, and then you can move on with life. Well, insights in the psychology of mourning, which I completely agree with, is that there's no need to cut the relation with the past. There's no need to cut the relation with your deceased. But what has to happen is that relationship has to change, has to transform. So if I take myself as an example, my parents have died years ago. I think I have a healthy relationship. I went through what they would call mourning, but there's no closure. Occasionally I think of them. That's fine, or I see something in my house that was theirs, and I said, that was my father bought this 30 years ago. Now, so there's no need to find closure. Mourning is true accepting that loss, that the person died, but that doesn't mean that there has to be closure. And I think that's the same with societies. There is no closure in Germany about the past, although politicians try to do, but you can transform it. You can institutionalize that relationship. You can say, well, we turn Auschwitz, Auschwitz is in Poland. Let's take Dachau. We turn Dachau into a museum. And children go there, there are programs there, there's a memorial service every year, and it's become part of German society and culture. And around the time of in May, there are films on television, there's documentaries. So people have a collective relationship with that past without denying it. Now, the thing is, in Germany, there is more or less a collective agreement about that past, that the Holocaust was not a good thing, etc., etc., etc. In Argentina, it hasn't yet arrived at that stage. In Argentina, there are people who are competing about the version of the past. And you could say that there are basically two versions. On one hand, there are the military and the veterans and their families and descendants who say, well, the military during the dictatorship fought a just war, an existential war even, that would have ended Argentina as it existed against these communists. And they, some of these commanders told me, you see what happened in Peru with the Sendero Luminoso? There are many, many, many more people were killed. Because they didn't intervene early enough. And we saved this country. And these military said to me, if I have to go to jail for this, okay, so be it. I've done the best for my country. I've saved my country from communism. While on the other hand, the human rights movement and people who were in the guerrilla movement and the political activists says we are victims of state terrorism. They have tortured us, they have killed us, they have disappeared us, all to advance a neoliberal capitalist system. And our sons and daughters wanted social justice. As one of them told me, my family is higher middle class. Our kids could have gone to Europe or to the United States to study. No, what did they do? They went to the slums of Buenos Aires to teach poor people how to read and write. That's what they did. That's the social. That's what they died for. And we want to keep their memory alive. So we have a Memorial Day. We have the Day of Human Rights. We have protests. We have museums to keep their memory alive. We write books, distribute photos. And now, today, since the arrival of Javier Milei, You could say the military side is until now winning the many memory politics, because museums are being dismantled. There's less money to find the disappeared children. There is less money to prosecute the perpetrators. So they're at this stage right now. And it is a roller coaster, but the high points become much lower points in the next period. Things are being destroyed that cannot be recuperated.
And but my sense is that there are these different phases that Argentina goes through. And of course, the military is defending and they have their own view of the world, their own justifications for what happened. Human rights groups have their understanding of the past, but it's the weight of the evidence that accumulates. It's the testimonies. It's the truth commissions. It's the exhumations. It's a body of evidence just that becomes overwhelming, that shifts the weight of the framework of understanding in one direction or another. And also you have certain presidents that can make all the difference in the world, that some can, I don't know, issue amnesty laws. Some could move in a direction of supporting institutions of memory. So there are a lot of factors as these groups vie for influence, as the evidence can accumulate in one direction or another, as certain political leaders weigh in on one side or another. That's that roller coaster isn't happening on its own. It's being steered. The winds are blowing it in one direction or another.
Yeah, well, you know, there's certain military who will admit that there were tortures, admit that there were disappearances, and their argument is, well, ultimately, it was for the good. You know, a lesser evil was done to avoid a greater evil. And then they go to geopolitics and say, what happened in Japan in 1945? The U.S. bombed, with two bombs, Japan. Was that just? Was that correct? Was that not, too much? Well, yeah, but it was a way to win the war. And there are other examples, the bombing of Dresden. Could you say the bombing of Dresden was a human rights violation? Well, you can in many ways, because it was not a military target. But then the Argentine military say, but you see, the Allied won the war, and the one who win the war, they defined the narrative about that particular war. And they said the thing has been that in Argentina, there have been periods in which our narrative was simply denied. And of course, there are exhumations, there are these secret detention centers, but the ultimate goal was the savior of Argentina from communism. So those are the arguments that are being used then by these military commanders and also by members in the government. You see, because then they will come with examples. Yeah, but what happened to German soldiers who were et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? What happened in Vietnam? You know, they come with examples like this. What happened in Algeria? And they said, well, we learned from, among others, the French, how to do these disappearances. The French were the first to throw Algerian, whatever you want to call them, guerrilla fighters, terrorists, freedom fighters, throw them alive from helicopters over the Mediterranean. I said, that's what we learned from them. And in Chile, they did the same thing. And in Argentina, they did it also. And, the way of, for instance, dividing a city into zones and then have mobile infantry units and intelligence units move within that zone to then capture their opponents was something which was invented by the French in the Battle of Algiers. It was also used by U.S. troops in Baghdad and in Fallujah. So you see how some of this knowledge then moves from country to country and is then used as a justification.
I guess I guess I'm still trying to understand the roller coaster, if only because, you know, my own country, I wish I couldn't relate to what you're writing as much as I can within my own context. But, you know, of course, we have January 6th happens and cast as an insurrection. People are put on trial, jailed, and now they are patriots and they're released. And what's changed? Well, a different president with a different agenda makes a lot of difference. He's taking control of cultural institutions. He can direct funds wherever he wants or starve institutions of funds. So there are certain real things that happen that shift, that cause you to go into a period of forgetting, that reinforce denial, or cause you to go in more of a direction of confrontation and recognition about the past. And Argentina seems to go through that. The evidence that accumulates, the leaders who are in place, maybe what's even happening internationally, the international context, all those things weigh in favor. And even if you go back to Alfonsín, his hand is forced. Maybe he wants a limited form of confrontation with the past. He doesn't want this to spiral out of control. And that was what I took away from the beginning of your book. Is that
I think there are two crucial variables here. First of all, that maybe explain this roller coaster. First of all, of course, the political color of the government. If you have a more, let's say, leftist government, it'll tend to prosecute the military. And when you have a more right-wing government or a government that says, well, we want to reconcile Argentina over this, like the government of Menem, then that's a period in which you could say the military narrative gets the upper hand. And also moments of, you could call it blackmail, where the military will say, well, we'll try another coup d'etat or something like that. So that's one. Another thing that I think that's being underestimated in this whole literature about memory politics in Argentina is the economic situation in Argentina. When it's economically going well, then you tend to see there's much interest in human rights and memory, etc. And when it's going economically bad, then the human rights narrative doesn't interest people. They want to know how much their coffee is going to cost or how much their bread is going to cost. And I witnessed it when I did my first major stint in Argentina, which happened under Alfonsín. Because the problem of Alfonsín was that he could not control inflation. And I remember sitting in my apartment and then going to buy some bread in the morning and go to my bakery around the corner and I would pay something. And then I would go in the afternoon and the price would be different. And they had their prices written on a piece of paper in pencil. And then every couple of hours, that price always went up. But there was no, the inflation was so great that things in the afternoon were higher than in the morning. I'll give you one tiny example. I wanted to buy a refrigerator. So I went to a store and I said, I want to buy this refrigerator, which is in your store. And the owner said, well, thank you very much for the business, but I cannot sell it to you. I said, why not? He said, I cannot sell it to you because I don't know the price. Because I have to sell it to you at a price that the factory is going to charge me so I can replace this a refrigerator with a new refrigerator. So in the afternoon, he figured out the price, made a deal with the factory, and then he could sell me the refrigerator. So inflation was so bad that Alfonsín resigned voluntarily and gave the presidency to Menem, who then started curbing inflation and et cetera, et cetera. And in that period of inflation, human rights were not an issue. People wanted bread on the table. And later when things improved, then under Menem, who then started say we have to reconcile as a society, a narrative reconciliation, then the human rights movement protested and said, no, this is not going to happen. You know, we wanna keep that memory alive. So the color of the government, political color, and also the economic swings, also a roller coaster in Argentina, of times of high inflation, times of low inflation.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I had an episode on rehabilitation of the memory of Stalin with Professor Todd Nelson. That was his point, that you have this transition from the Soviet Union to a new democratic system in the 1990s, and it's a period of economic chaos. And they really didn't have the luxury to look at the past. It wasn't their concern. There wasn't a whole lot of soul searching. They had other priorities, and maybe there was a miss. The economic context was just not opportune, and who knows how things could have gone different. I mean, you could blame international partners maybe for missing an opportunity there to ease the transition to a democratic system. And then once you get to Putin, well, then the past is open to exploitation.
And so, there's also the factor of time, of course, right? So the high command, those have all died of the dictatorship. But you still have the low-ranking military who were actually doing the torturing and the killing, the lieutenants and the captains and the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants. But they had been benefited by an amnesty at a certain moment in Argentina. They came up with what they called the due obedience law in 1987, because the military were saying at that time, this was just happened just after the military juntas had been convicted in court. The military said, well, you know, are you now going to prosecute thousands and thousands of military? We're not going to accept this. That the people who were during the dictatorship a lieutenant and who's now a captain or a colonel or a major is going to be prosecuted. We're not going to accept that. So then they came up with this due obedience law. And that meant that in Germany, they would call it Befehl ist Befehl. An order is an order. If you were ordered to do certain things by your superiors, then your superiors are responsible and you are not responsible. So many, many low-ranking officers and non-commissioned officers got off scot-free. So the number of prosecutions declined rapidly, but even that was not enough for the military. Then they said, but this is unfair, that then these commanders who have saved the country from communism are now being prosecuted. And then these pardons came. Now we're going to pardon everybody, also those who are in jail. They're going to be out, and also we're going to pardon the guerrilla commanders that are being prosecuted. We're going to pardon everybody and then reconcile society. That was the idea. Leave the past. And then you get a change of government, and the new government says, hey, we're not going to do this. We're going to find new charges. And the new charges were, as I said earlier, because of the kidnapping of babies. And the Organization of American States was crucial in that. And saying, you can do that, you know.
Tony, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today, especially on your Saturday. Very nice of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tony Robin is a professor emeritus from Utrecht University in the Netherlands. I've been talking with him about his book, Argentina Betrayed, Memory, Mourning, and Accountability. You can listen to an extended version of my conversation with Tony Robin on the new Realms of Memory Patreon page. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.